Well, last week we talked about Leviticus, and the idea that Leviticus is ripe for illustration. And after Sunday school, a couple of people asked about the Bible Project. Was that who I was talking about? And the answer is no. But I thought I would mention that just to fill in the gaps there for some of you. There's this organization called the Bible Project, and for years they've been making these 5 or 10 minute little videos that are kind of like podcasts. A lot of you would be familiar with that. There are these two guys, and they have a conversation about some Bible topic. And while they're talking, they illustrate what they're talking about on the screen with graphics, which is really interesting. And I haven't seen all of them. I don't know that I could give them a blanket endorsement. I think I like their old ones better than some of their new ones. But one of the best things they did, one of the famous things they did, was they did a video overview of every book of the Bible. And the ones of the, I haven't seen all 66 of those either, but the ones that I've seen actually seem to be pretty good. So if you wanted a little 8 minute overview of the book of Leviticus or the book of Numbers, you could go look for the Bible Project, and that's an interesting available tool. I like the ones that I've seen, although I'm not sure I could endorse everything, but that's the Bible Project, and that came up last week. So let's review just a little bit and get a running start at Numbers. 2 weeks ago, we looked at Exodus. Exodus is a very familiar book. Exodus is full of lots of famous stories. And Exodus is easy to connect together in your mind into a whole, because there's one central character that connects all of the stories in Exodus. That's Moses. And there's one central storyline. The nation is coming out of Egypt, and they're meeting God at Sinai. So Exodus, the structure of the book, the theme of the book, the outline of the book, is actually pretty obvious. When you come to Leviticus, there aren't a lot of stories. There's not really a storyline at all. That's one of the things that makes Leviticus hard. But there is a theme. There's an obvious theme to the book of Leviticus, and that is the holiness of God. They built this tabernacle. If God's going to dwell among us, God is holy. So you be holy, because God is holy. The book of Leviticus has a pretty obvious theme. Then we come to the book of Numbers. And Numbers seems familiar to us, like Exodus does. Numbers is full of famous stories. We've got the 12 spies. We've got Balaam's talking donkey. We've got manna. We've got the bronze serpent. We've got Aaron's rod. We've got Miriam's leprosy. We kind of think we know the book of Numbers because it's got lots of stories in it. But it's not like Exodus, because there's not one central character. The book of Numbers has a big cast of characters. There's Balaam, there's Korah, there's Miriam. There's a lot of things going on in the book of Numbers. And there's not really an obvious single storyline. There are some big events, but there's lots of little stories. And when you start trying to put them together into what's the theme, what's the outline, what's the structure of the book of Numbers, it's actually pretty complicated. It turns out there's a lot of dispute about the theme of the book of Numbers. In fact, it's so complicated. Some of you know David Shumate. Some of you remember him. He got a law degree from Harvard. So he's a pretty smart guy. And then he was converted. So he came to Bob Jones, and he did a PhD in the seminary at Bob Jones. And now he leads MGM International. He's down in Phoenix. He's a big mission organization. That's David Shumate. A lot of you know him. He wrote his PhD dissertation on the subject of what is the theme of the book of Numbers. That's the subject of his PhD dissertation. And that gives you a taste of the fact that it's not a trivial question. So I thought a good way to introduce this would be to give us a little English lesson this morning. Because there is an idiom that was popular back in the 1800s, a little bit of slang, that kind of disappeared, and just recently it's made a comeback. There is a word mess that originally came from Latin, and it meant food. Mess was food, particularly a big bowl of mushy food or a big bowl of different kinds of food mixed up together. We still have it in our language as the word mess hall. You know that word? It's like a cafeteria for soldiers where you get served big tubs that are probably not very good food. So that's what the word mess meant. It was food, but very quickly it took on a figurative meaning. Any situation in life that's kind of a jumbled, mixed up, chaotic situation, people started referring to that as a mess. And we still have that word in English today. That's the way we think of the word mess. So a hot mess was a hot meal originally. And it quickly took on this figurative meaning of an especially bad mess. A big mess is a hot mess. And then that phrase kind of disappeared. Until fairly recently, I don't know if you've noticed, but hot mess is making a comeback. People are starting to use that phrase to describe something that's really messed up, that's really bad. It's kind of like, maybe you know the phrase dumpster fire? That's very similar. Something that's really messed up. Now, there's a twist to this, and I'm not necessarily recommending that you add this to your vocabulary, because hot has another colloquial meaning. Hot is an adjective applied to an attractive woman, and not necessarily just in like an aesthetic, beautiful way, but maybe a sensual, suggestive way. So you don't want to say that about a woman. To call a woman a hot mess is to suggest something different. And that makes me a little reluctant to use the word, but it is being used widely in our culture for a big mess. And I'm saying that because that's the phrase that came to my mind when I started studying the outline of the book of Numbers. There is a sense in which this book is a hot mess. David Shumate read over 70 commentaries on the book of Numbers, researching his dissertation. And he said, quote, "It's a difficult book to study systematically." This is the guy with a PhD and a law degree from Harvard. And he's saying, you know, this is a hard book to study systematically. One of the interesting things in his book, he has this chart where he sorted all the commentators. Some of them divide Numbers into two sections. Some of them divide Numbers into three sections, or four sections, or five sections, or six sections, or seven sections, or eight sections. All these different ways to organize the book. And he said, there are a lot of schemes, there are a lot of proposals, but none of them are entirely satisfactory. None of them seem to take all of the stories that are in the book of Numbers and put them together into a whole. It's just a collection of stories. Now, I want to be clear, I'm not saying that God made a mess of this book. What David Shumate is saying, the commentaries are a mess. Because the structure of this book is complicated. The structure of this book is not obvious. And obviously, God had a reason for that. God had a purpose for that. And we might be able to discover a little bit of that. But what I'm saying is, we have our hands full this morning. When we come to this room of the museum, this room of the museum strikes you as a big, complicated mess. And you could just stop and look at the individual stories. And I could tell you the story of Balaam. We could have a lesson about Balaam. We could talk about Korah's rebellion. We could talk about the bronze serpent. But when you try to put all of those into some kind of a whole, there's a bit of a mystery here. So let's explore that a little bit. Starting with, I think we are misled from the beginning because the book has an awkward name. We call this the Book of Numbers. And we call it that because it starts out with a numbering, with a census. But that's actually not a great summary of the book. That's not the theme of the book. There are two censuses in this book, and they only cover three chapters. 90% of the book is something else. If that's your concept of the book of Numbers, oh, it's a bunch of tables of genealogies and census and counting people, that's actually a very small part of the book. And by the way, it's not a census. What they're doing is they're organizing to go to war. Are you open to Numbers? Go ahead and turn to Numbers. And we'll start looking at some things now as we talk about it. Numbers chapter 1 and verse 2, God says, take a census, take a numbering, take account of the people. But look at verse 3. from 20 years old and upward, whoever is able to go to war, you and Aaron shall number them by their armies. And look at chapter 2 and verse 3. Now those who camp on the east side toward the sunrise shall be the standard of the camp of Judah by their armies and their leader and his army. What's happening here is we're getting into like battle array, battle formation. We're counting the soldiers. We're arranging them in a circle around the tabernacle, out on the edges of the camp, because this nation is about to go to war. They're not just going to the promised land, they're going to have to conquer the promised land. So that's definitely part of what's going on in this book, but that's like 10% of the book. So that's not the theme. Now, there is one thing about that that's really important, and that is that there are two censuses. It happens in chapter 1, and it happens again in chapter 26. And why are there two? You probably know the answer to that question. Why do we do this twice? Do you know?
Before they had to go back.
It's a new generation. They started to go up and they chickened out and they turned back. And God said, okay, you're going to wander in the wilderness. You're going to die in the wilderness. The second census is a whole new generation. We need a new count. We need a new structure. We need a new organization, because this is really like a whole new nation. That old generation is dead. And a new generation is going to try again, if I can say it that way. The people that divide the book in two parts, that's the way they divide it. This is a story of two generations. There's a generation that tried and failed to enter the promised land. Then there's another generation that tried and succeeded to enter the promised land. And there's some truth to that. That is absolutely how the book starts and ends. The problem is, most of the book is stuff in the middle that doesn't have anything to do with the two generations. That's just a little bit part of the book. So, the title Numbers confuses us, and that's okay, because that's not an inspired title. That's not what God called this book. That's not even what the Hebrews called this book. In the Hebrew Bible, this book had the title Wilderness. And that's where it happened. That's the first line of the book, in the wilderness. God spoke to Moses in the wilderness. So the Hebrew Bible, they called it the wilderness. And that's certainly where it happened. But that's not a theme either. That's not a storyline either. There are certainly places in this book. There's travel in this book. And some commentators have suggested that's the way to organize the book. Look at where they are. Look at what's happening where. Look at their travels. Look at their journeys. That's definitely a part of what's going on. But as an overarching structure of the book, theme of the book, that's really not sufficient either. It's a lot of things that happen that don't have anything to do with location or the wilderness. So, Numbers, that's in the book, but it's not the theme. The wilderness, that's in the book, but it's not the theme. If you would have asked me 2 months ago, before I started working on this study, what's the theme of the book of Numbers, I think I would have said wandering. Because my concept of this book was, this is where the wilderness wanderings happened. That first generation refused to go in, so they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. That's why we have two generations. But here's the thing that really struck me this week as I studied this book. In the book, the wandering years are hard to find. Most of this book happens either before they started wandering or after they got reorganized and they prepared to enter the promised land. We don't have time for this today, but if you want an interesting little personal study, you could sit down with the book of Numbers and start at the front and just skim through and find the place where they turn back, where they refuse to go farther, where they reject God, and where God says, okay, you're going to wander in the wilderness. Find that point in the book. Everything that happens before that is before the wanderings. And then go to the end of the book and find the place where the wanderings are over. and we're now got a new generation, and we're getting ready to go in the promised land. And you're going to find out that that covers most of the book. And the stories that actually happened during the wanderings, it's almost like the wandering years just completely disappear. This book is actually not about what happened during those 40 years of wandering. We know very little about what happened during those 40 years of wandering. Those years were just wasted. And there's a lesson in that. I think that's part of the point of the book. Those 40 years just disappear. And you will struggle to find them, honestly. To nail down this chapter, this verse, this story happens during the wanderings, that is very, very hard to nail down. So, this book is not really about the wanderings. It's about what led up to them, why they wandered. It's about what happened to the next generation after they wandered. It's really not a book about wanderings either. So, what does David Shumay think? I did go and skim through his dissertation, and he has a proposed theme for the book. And at first, it didn't really appeal to me, but the more I thought about it, the more I like it. He said, this is a book about leadership. The theme of this book, he suggested, is leadership. Number one, God's success as a perfect leader. God is leading this nation through 36 chapters of a big hot mess. And he's a perfect leader. And at the same time, the failure of human leadership. This book is full of failures on the part of human leaders and human conflict and human struggle. I mean, I could just say it this way. The test of your leadership is when everything you're trying to lead and organize turns into a mess. That's kind of what we see as God gives these people the law and the tabernacle and the Levitical order. And they start to try to do all of that. And very quickly, it disintegrates into a big mess. But God is not fazed. And God is not taken off track. And God is able to eventually get these people to the promised land. God is like the perfect leader. In contrast to Moses, who is a great leader, but these people are so messed up that they even push Moses to the brink, where Moses eventually seems to lose his temper and react wrongly. Moses eventually fails in his leadership. And Aaron is a pretty good leader too. We don't pay a lot of attention to Aaron, I think. We don't have necessarily a lot of respect for him. But he was God's appointed leader for this nation spiritually. And Aaron did a lot of good. But as you know, Aaron failed as a leader. In the book of Numbers, he's going to rebel against God's leadership. It's only God that through the whole book of Numbers never loses control, never loses track of where he's going and what the mission is and how this is going to work. So let's go through the book a little bit. And I want to just look for this particular theme of leadership and see how that connects together a lot of these seemingly disconnected stories in the book. So are we still in Numbers 1? Look at the opening words of the book. The Lord spoke to Moses. This is God exerting leadership. This is God structuring the army. This is God organizing the camp. I mean, you would expect normally this is what a king does, or this is what a commanding general does. Later on, it's going to be Joshua organizes the people. David, King David, has a census, right? Famously. It's part of David's story. This is the kind of thing that a king should be doing, but there's no king. Because God is acting like king here, and God is giving directions, and God is saying, this is our battle array. This is our army structure. This is how we're going to lay out the camp. This is God as the commander in chief. Look at chapter 1, verse 47. The Levites were not numbered. We're going to skip one of the tribes. We're not going to count the Levites. They're not part of this battle array. They're not actually put on the front lines. Why not?
Because they're priests.
Look at verse 48. Verse 49, only the tribe of Levi you shall not number. Look at verse 48. Because God said so. God has his reasons, and God made the decision. This is not Moses saying, I think it would be a good idea if we would just let the priests handle the tabernacle. That might make sense. There might be a good reason for that, but that's not what's going on here. We're doing this because God said, please skip the Levites. God said that. And verse 2:2, the sons of Israel shall camp by their own standard. This is how they're going to be arranged. Look at verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses. This is God personally directing the nation. We have a word for a government that is ruled directly by God as the supreme civil authority. What do we call it when God is the king? Call it a theocracy. That's what's going on in Numbers. This is actually what David Shumate means by leadership. By leadership, he means God as the commander-in-chief of the army. God as a theocracy. God is their king. This is a book about God leading this nation as a theocracy. Now, a very important part of that, we could easily misunderstand that. Look at chapter 3, verse 3. Now we are going to count the names of the sons of Aaron because they are the anointed priests. They are in a position of ministry. They're in a position of leadership. How did they get that position? Which he ordained to serve as priests. He being God. Because this is part of a theocracy. We think of theocracy as rule by God. But there is still this element of rule by God through human leadership. There's not a king, but even in a theocracy, there's a human leadership. There's an appointed high priest, and he was chosen not by democratic vote, not by appointment of the king, not by any human choice. He is a spiritual authority over the people, but he's put there by God. Who God appointed, God ordained to serve as priests. So there's this delegation of authority. And if you could just jump ahead to chapter 7. On the day that Moses finished setting up the tabernacle, he anointed it and consecrated it. With all its furnishings and the altar and the utensils, he anointed them and consecrated them. This is Moses and his leadership. And then verse 2, then the leaders of Israel, the heads of their father's households, they came and they made an offering. These are not priests. These are more like political leaders. These are like governors of the tribes. See, God is setting up a religious authority structure, the priests and the Levites. God is setting up kind of a civil political structure. There's Moses, and there are these heads of the father's households. There's a political structure here. And by the way, what comes next is about six chapters that sounds like Leviticus. At this point in the book of Numbers, we have six chapters of regulations from God, instructions from God. It's like a postscript to the book of Leviticus. And that makes sense because God has just put these people in leadership. And now that they're actually serving in those positions, God is saying, I've got some more instructions for you. It was kind of like Leviticus was the setup manual. Leviticus was the starting instructions to get the nation started. We had to go through Leviticus to get the priests organized, to get the priests ordained. There was that big 7-day ordination ceremony for the priests. It took the whole book of Leviticus just to get that all set up and working. And God says, okay, now that we're up and running, the tabernacle's running, the priests are serving, here's 7 more chapters of stuff you need to know. Here's 7 more chapters of instructions. That's part of what's in the book of Numbers. Now, I want to point out that delegating leadership is not unique to a theocracy. You can go all the way back to Genesis 1. And God creates Adam and Eve, and he says, on that day, let them have dominion. God puts Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden and he gives them a job. He tells them it's their job to dress it and to keep it, to guard it, to take care of it. This has always been the way that God worked. From the beginning, God's the supreme ruler of the universe. And he said to Adam and Eve, okay, you're in charge of Eden. I'm delegating running Eden to you. And you come to the New Testament church, and we're told that God gives apostles and prophets and pastors and teachers. There's an authority structure. Christ is obviously the head of the church, but under his headship, there is this human authority. That's part of the way that God leads. So there's a sense in which this is a book about leadership. There's a sense in which it's a book about human leadership. But ultimately, it's all about God's leadership. So we've seen that thread of leadership. And in the first seven chapters, God sets that all up. This is how the nation works. I'm the ruler. I'm present with you in the tabernacle, the tent of meeting. Your leadership, Moses and Aaron, you can come to meet with me in the tabernacle. And you can find out what we need to do. You can run this nation. That only takes about six or eight chapters. And then what immediately happens is the people start rebelling against leadership. Said the theme of the book is rebellion. What makes it a hot mess? The theme of those middle chapters of the book that are so confusing. It's not leadership, it's rebellion against leadership. That's what makes the book so messy. You could say the theme of the book is rebellion, but that would be too negative. You could say the theme of the book is how God shows his leadership by overcoming all kinds of rebellion. That's what's going on in this book. So let's get a little taste of that. Look at chapter 10. Chapter 10 is a huge turning point in the book when in verse 11, in the second year, in the second month, on the 20th of the month, that's how long they've been at Sinai. Numbers 10:11, the cloud was lifted up and the sons of Israel set out on their journeys. If you're trying to follow a storyline in this book, that's a huge marker. We've been getting ready to march for 10 chapters. And chapter 10, verse 11, verse 12 is where we actually start the march to the promised land. And look at chapter 11, verse 1. This is what happens almost immediately. The people became like those who complain of adversity. The people immediately, as you know, set to complaining. They are a grumbling, complaining people over and over again. Chapter 4, the rabble who were among them had greedy desires. And it wasn't just the rabble. The sons of Israel wept. And they said, who will give us meat to eat? You know these verses. This is a famous story. We remember the fish, which we used to eat. The cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. But now our appetite is gone. There is nothing at all to look at except this manna. That is an amazing complaint. That is an amazing statement. We are so upset, we have nothing to eat but manna. Manna that Psalms calls angels' food. Manna that was described as food straight from heaven. And you're complaining because all you've got to eat is angels' food from heaven? What were you going to say?
It's nothing different with us.
That is so true. That is exactly right. I've got nothing to wear except this closet full of clothes. I've got nothing to drive except this perfectly functioning old car. I've got nothing to eat except this year-round supply of fresh food. And the problem is, we all so easily focus on what we don't have. They missed the melons. They had melons back in Egypt, and there aren't any melons around Sinai. And God is not giving them melons from heaven. And they missed that, and they're sorry about that. Some of you have had the experience of being overseas for an extended period of time. And after some weeks or months in Korea, you start to miss. There are certain foods that are just not available. And we can focus on the things that we don't have. And that's what's going on here. Yeah, we have this manna, and that's great, but I'm consumed with this thought of this thing that I don't have, and so we grumble and we complain, and that ultimately leads to rebellion. So there's a lesson for us every time we read the book of Numbers. This is kind of a highlight of this book in terms of personal application. Are you ever saying, I have nothing but manna to eat? We have this song, Count Your Blessings, right? And that's exactly right. That's exactly what we need to do. Focus on the manna. Don't focus on the melons that you don't have. And this is so serious because chapter 12, this line of thinking, of grumbling, of discontent, quickly leads to rebellion. This is not about food. But chapter 12, verse 1, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of, they've got a particular complaint that's stuck in their mind, the Cushite woman who he married. They're not happy about Moses' wife. But notice what they say. They don't say, hey, Moses, you married the wrong woman. Hey, Moses, we are not happy with you and your family. What did they say in verse 2? What's the challenge? Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well? This is actually a challenge to Moses' leadership. I mean, they've got a complaint. They're upset about his wife. But that's not really the heart issue. That's not really the root here. They're using that as an excuse to voice their discontent that they don't like that God put Moses in a position of leadership and not them. I think there's a little bit of jealousy here. There's a little bit of discontent with their place. And boy, we could stop and camp on that for a while and apply that. Do we look at the ministries God has given other people? Even in a church like this, are there people grumbling and complaining and saying, why is he an elder and not me? Why is he a deacon and not me? Why did they make her an LMPG officer and not me? Why did he get the sign ministry and not me? We look at the ministry that God has given people, and we can be just like Miriam and Aaron, and we can say, well, why can't that be me? Why shouldn't that be me? Don't I deserve that? And when you stop and hear yourself talking, when you hear somebody else say, we have nothing to eat but manna, it makes you want to laugh. When you hear someone say, shouldn't I be the one in a position of authority? It sounds pretty selfish. It sounds pretty prideful. It doesn't sound right. But in our own minds, we are really good at making sense of that. I got nothing to eat but manna. It makes sense to me. I think I should be in that position of leadership. It makes sense to me. I read this week, it really made me stop and think. Somebody said that smart people are especially good at deceiving themselves. The smart people are more likely to be hypocritic because they're really good at making up rationalizations for what they want to do, for their selfish desires. They're really good at coming up with excuses why this really is right, why I really should have melons, why I am the one who should be in that position of leadership, whatever. That really made me stop and think. He's saying the smarter you are, the more careful you ought to be that you're not just deceiving yourself with all of your smart rationalizations for what you're thinking. Here is Miriam and Aaron directly challenging the leadership of Moses. Look at chapter 14. Chapter 14, verse 1, all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept. All the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said, wish that we had died in the land of Egypt. And then look at verse 3. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land? Because when you challenge God's human authorities, you are ultimately accusing God of bad leadership. Why is he an elder and not me? Because God must have made a mistake. Right? Why are you thinking that you should be the elder and not him, if you're not thinking that God made a mistake here? God, Christ, is the head of the church. He gives us apostles and elders and teachers and deacons. And when we grumble against our human leadership, we are saying, I think God made a mistake here. Isn't this something that every child eventually has to face when you're rebelling against your parents, when you are disagreeing with your parents' decisions? And ultimately what that leads to is, God put me in the wrong family. God made a mistake. God gave me the wrong parents. God, what were you thinking? Giving me these parents that have made these decisions that seem so wrong to me. That's not just a criticism of your parents. That's a criticism of God. And that comes through here very clearly in chapter 14. Verse 2, they grumbled against Moses and Aaron. But they know what that means in verse 3. That means the Lord gave us the wrong leadership. And the Lord led us astray. See, David Shoemate said, this is a book about leadership, and ultimately it's a book about God's leadership. Chapter 16. You know this story. Verse 1, Korah and his buddies. Verse 2, they rose up before Moses. Verse 3, they assembled together against Moses and Aaron, and they said, you have gone far enough, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst. So why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord? This is open-faced rebellion against leadership. Why do you think you are in a position of leadership? Why can you tell us what to do? Can't we figure out what to do? Aren't we ordained priests by God too? This is a direct challenge against leadership. And you know how that worked out, right? Look at verse 41. When Korah and his buddies are killed, this is Numbers 16:41. The next day, all the congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, saying, you are the ones who have caused the death of the Lord's people. Things have turned into a mess, and it's your fault. It's the leadership's fault. Chapter 20 and verse 4. Verse 3, the people contended with Moses, if we had only perished when our brothers perished, why then have you brought the Lord's assembly into this wilderness for us and our beasts to die here? Chapter 21, verse 5, the people spoke against God and against Moses, why have you brought us out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? So if there is a theme to the middle of this book, that's kind of it. Let's just look at one more. We're going to run out of time here. Chapter 25. This is another famous story. When the people remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab. This is really a crisis. Now look at verse 4. The Lord said to Moses, do what? Take all the leaders of the people and execute them. This is a failure of leadership. What is the story in Numbers 25? It's a story of immorality. What else is the story in Numbers 25? It's a story of failure of leadership. Now, that's as far as I want to go down that, because I want to talk about at least one point of application. What are we supposed to take away from a book that's full of rebellion against leadership? And there's a Bible answer in 1 Corinthians 10. If you want to know how do I apply the book of Numbers to me practically today, I would say read 1 Corinthians 10. Because that's exactly what Paul does. Let's read here quickly. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 1. I don't want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud. They all passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses. They all ate the same spiritual food. They all drank the same spiritual drink. Verse 5, nevertheless, with most of them God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. We're talking about the book of Numbers. Paul is applying the book of Numbers to us. Now, verse 6, these things happened as examples for us. Can we read the book of Numbers with that thought in the back of our minds? This was intended to be an example for me. Korah, Balaam, Miriam, brass serpent, strike the rock, all these famous stories in Numbers, every one of those was intended to be an example for you. Now, looking at those examples, Paul points out two reactions that are wrong. You might read the book of Numbers and you might come away with the wrong application. So look at verse 12. Here would be a wrong conclusion from the book of Numbers. Let him who thinks he stands. I would never be that dumb. I would never be that rebellious. Those stupid people, what were they thinking? How can you get tired of manna? How can you complain against this God who has among you in a cloud? Those people were so dumb, I would never do that. Paul says, let him who thinks he stands, you take heed, because you might fall in the very same way. That's the wrong takeaway from the book of Numbers, to have a proud sense of I'm better than them. What were they thinking? They were so dumb. I know better. But there's another reaction that's at the other extreme that would also be wrong, and that's verse 13. No temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. God is faithful. He will not allow you to be tempted above what you're able. There will be a way of escape. One extreme reaction is pride. I would never do that. The other wrong reaction is despair. Is there any hope? Can things ever go better? I mean, if this is really just human nature, if the best of God's leaders, I mean, if Moses failed, how can I ever succeed as a leader? If Aaron failed, how can I ever succeed as a pastor? How can we ever get anywhere in life if this is what people are like and we're constantly grumbling and complaining? This can lead you to defeat, to despair, to discouragement. To say, wow, that would never happen to me, is the wrong takeaway. But to say, well, there's no hope. You know, nobody's perfect. We're going to have struggles. It's not going to go well. We can't do any better. No, no, no. You're supposed to learn from those examples so that you can do better. That's the point. Grumbling can start to rise in my heart, and I can remember Numbers. In my mind flashes that thought, I have nothing but manna to eat. And I say, wow, is that what I'm saying? Is that what I'm doing? Is that me? Those examples can correct us. Those examples can steer our thinking. Those examples can help us to respond rightly. So, wow, there's a lot of food for thought. We're going to have to quit. We're over time, so let's pray. Father, help us to learn from these things. As we read, really, the whole Old Testament, all of the Scriptures, you gave us these things to learn, not to be disheartened, not to be proud, but to learn from them and to do better because we have them as examples to encourage us. Encourage us today with these things. Encourage us today with what we hear from your word in the service that follows. In Jesus' name. Amen.